Accession number 8702, roll number 2.
Mrs. Owen, take 2. You were telling me about the food, Mrs. Owen, and this is very interesting.
Well, every English house, obviously, we all had supplies of tinned food. As ordinary houses do and ordinary larders do. I mean, I presume it was bought locally, and also people used to send for stuff, I think, from America. I think, but then, I mean, that all happened before we got there. I mean, I don't know how tinned food was come by, but people had ordinary sort of tins of pineapples and peaches and various ordinary tinned food, and it was... H.E. said that everybody was to take their tinned food to the Chancery Building. Every single thing, I mean, it was a sort of made quite clear that it would be regarded as a cardinal offence to leave even so much of a tin of anchovies behind in your larder. And it was an enormous quantity that was amassed, rather like the loaves and fishes. And it really was an enormous amount. And then that was put that people could get food, tinned food. You had to go and the cook boys went and got the rations, I think 2 or 3 times a week. And they asked for, and either if Mrs. Mason had it, she gave it, or if she didn't have it, she didn't give it. And of fresh food, we had ox tail, but literally not the sort of nubbly stuff that you make oxtail soup out of. It was actually the sort of actual tail bit that the ox flapped away the flies with, which was very stringy and perfectly disgusting, and an appalling vegetable called a daikon, which looked like an overgrown turnip. And it had the most lethal smell. And I thought I'd completely forgotten the smell, but when we were in Singapore in 1961, I smelt daikon again. And it's a quite unforgettable smell. It's like a Swede, only 10 times worse. And that was the only fresh vegetable we had continuously. We obviously got other fresh vegetables in because I don't remember that there were great short. I think the adults were sort of concerned about shortage of vitamins and things like that, but I adored rice, so I did frightfully well. I ate vast quantities of rice.
And the Japanese supplied the rice,
yes,
did they?
Fresh rice.
Basic
rice and this oxtail stuff and this daikon.
So presumably that would have been your basic food, which was supplemented by your pile of stuff.
Tin stuff.
How was this shared out? You know, your the
I don't remember exactly how it was done, but I know that Mrs. Mason, who got the OBE for her efforts when we were repatriated, ruled us with an absolute rod of iron, and there were awful sort of accusations that Mrs. Mason gave more to one house than to another, and that she favouritised the ambassador's wife. Lady Craigie was American and very, very fussy and precious and spoiled. This is slanderous. Everybody was convinced that Mrs. Mason was sort of in the pay of Lady Craigie, and that Lady Craigie at number one house, which the residence was always called, was number one, had better food than the rest of the houses, which I don't think was at all true. Mrs. Mason was absolutely like Caesar's wife.
Did you ever have any little luxuries, such as sweets or chocolate? The children, were you given?
I think the very young children were probably given extra sweets. Because I was 16 and had my 17th birthday in there, I think I ate the same food as the adults. I don't remember getting extra chocolates or anything. But equally, I was never particularly into sweet things. But I know that my father insisted that I smoke 3 cigarettes a day for the nerves. I didn't have nerves at all, but he thought that as he was in a nervous tension state, and he smoked about 60 a day, he thought that my nerves must also be feeling like his, so he advised me to smoke 3 a day, which got me on to 40 a day, and I only gave up this time last year. So with the best will in the world, he taught me to smoke.
Did you find most of the adults were very anxious? You know, did this
manifest? Oh, yes, the grown-up adults. I mean, the young adults, the secretaries, they were all carried on flirting and things just as they'd gone on before. I mean, there were various couples, you know. I remember sort of a young secretary and her boyfriend who was a young vice consul, and they went round sort of having boyfriends and girlfriends, and I mean, just they had to be slightly less selective about it. You know, you had to make the boyfriend the one, the immediately available boy. And I, being a convent girl, was very underdeveloped, and so sort of, I think I had a crush on the chap who taught me shorthand, who was a wonderful man who was a, he had no business to be, he actually lived in our annex, which was a Japanese house, because the first secretary before had been rather eccentric and had sort of almost gone native. And he'd had an annex built that was literally a perfect Japanese house. And this man called Trevor Leggett lived in it, who was in Japan on a judo scholarship because he was the best judo player that England had ever produced at that time. But he was also there. He had some other function. I can't remember what it was. But he was a brilliant shorthand writer. So he was one of the people who went up into the roof to listen to the news.
Yes, I must ask you about that later on.
And he taught me shorthand so that I was at least learning something while I was there.
Yes, I must look into that as well. While we're on the subject of food, though, you'll think I'm obsessed with food. What did you drink while you were in the
Do you know, I just don't remember. I remember, again, my father sort of saying, now, before lunch, I must have a glass of sherry, because that was sort of a grown-up thing to do, and I was now old enough to have a glass of sherry. But there appeared to be vast quantities of drink about at parties, but where it all came from, I have no idea. I presume it was the drink that people had in their houses, which they thought there's no point in saving. And as everybody, being diplomats, had duty-free drink. I mean, they all had lashings of Scotch whisky and finest French wines and everything, and I presume, I mean, people were always giving parties in their houses. I mean, we were all frightfully social. We had parties in one or other houses every night of the week, practically.
Right up until repatriation,
oh,
did
yes.
this go on?
Oh, yes, furiously. It was a tremendous social life.
Was it rather frenetic? Now, was there anxiety behind this, do you think?
No, I don't think so. I think the grown-ups, I mean, the sort of senior officers, had almost given up thoughts that we were ever going to be repatriated, because the intermediary power was the Argentine. It was a beautiful, snake-hipped young man called Mr. Villar, who used to come and play bridge with the ladies, who thought he was quite wonderful, but he did absolutely nothing. And Mr. Anthony Eden, who was the Foreign Secretary, sent us a charming telegram to HE saying that the delay in our repatriation was due to the various commitments of HM government in various parts of the world, which infuriated people like my father, who felt that they could have been getting on with repatriating us a bit faster. And eventually the Argentinian was recognised as being totally incompetent and was replaced by the Swiss, who was a Dr. Pallavicini, who had us out within 3 weeks flat. The repatriation was arranged literally within 3 weeks.
Were you sort of on tenterhooks all the time about repatriation, did you find?
I think one used to sort of say if Villar or Pallavicini had been to the embassy and one knew they had any news, you used to say. And people sort of sounded disheartened if there wasn't any news. But on the other hand, as we were all sort of so adaptable, we'd almost got into a routine with our lives.
What was your routine? Could you think of a sort of typical day, as much as you can remember?
Well, we...
Where were you... You said you were sleeping on a sofa in the beginning. Were you still on your little sofa?
No, I don't think so. I think I must have eventually got a bed, but I have no recollection of where I...
You were with your parents, were you, in the same house?
I think I probably... Oh, it's in the same house, yes. Yeah, we were living in our own house.
Families were kept together, were they?
Yes.
Was that the policy?
Yes, yes, yes. We were living in our own house. And the other people had come into our house, but we already had a house in the compound. I know that I... The day used to start off with me having a shorthand lesson. And this man Leggett was a very hard taskmaster. So it used to go on for sort of 2 to 3 hours. And then we'd have lunch. And then in the afternoon, I used to play squash or badminton because we had a squash court there. And take some sort of exercise, I suppose. And then in the evenings we used to have parties, and I was also learning to type, and I was also having German lessons, because I already spoke a lot of German, so this was more by way of practice than an actual lesson. But my parents were determined to sort of keep up some standard of education and keep me busy. And then we played ping pong a lot. We had tremendous table tennis tournaments. And in a room in the chancery, the table tennis was set up. And I think I spent an enormous quantity of time doing that. I really got quite good at it. And so much so that when I joined the WAF later on, I played table tennis for the WAF on one notable occasion in which I was defeated. But one had very sort of placid days. Mostly the meals were the great enlivener, because there'd be Mrs. Cowley making a fuss about something.
And did you have your meals together?
Yes, all waited on by the butler and everything, in
yes.
great style, with the silver out and everything.
In a big hall, was this?
No, in our dining room.
Oh, I see. Yes, so the individual houses would have had meals. Am
oh,
I
yes.
right in thinking?
Yes, yes,
you,
yes, yes.
Yes, your own servants would have
yes,
looked after you
yes.
in the houses.
Oh, yes, gracious living.
And you still continued this gracious
oh, yes.
living?
Oh, yes. I mean, the servants never hesitated. I mean, went on as if there'd never been a break. And you had people to lunch, you see, from other houses.
So really it was business as usual?
Yes, only on a reduced scale.
Did the food decline in sort of quantity or quality within your period in the embassy?
I think it must have declined in both, but I don't actually remember that it did, except that poor old Mrs. Mason got more and more cross, as she had less and less to give out. But I think that certainly the fresh surprise didn't decrease at all, because the Japanese were terrified that if they took out anything on us, then it would be taken out on their people in London and in Washington, respectively.
You were saying about your own occupations, you know, how you played ping pong and you had your various lessons. Did this happen generally? Were most people kept occupied, do you think?
I think so, yes. I mean, the chancery people used to make out, one of the things that I did was type out enormous lists, because lists had to be made of every single British subject for repatriation, because we were repatriated by name and number. I mean, we weren't just allowed to say 20 people from such a house. It had to be name and age and date of birth for every single person. And this preparation for repatriation went on from day one. And so typing out of lists was one of my great occupations. And I presume, I mean, other the other secretaries, competent typists, did the same. Because they were all the secretarial staff were there.
What did your father do? What was his function?
I don't know. He sort of went away and did things in secret with HE. I have no idea what they did. I suppose they perhaps initiated the lists. They hadn't really much to do, but they sort of conferred and did things. Daddy used to go over and see HE every day.
Was there a school set up as well inside the compound for the younger children?
Nope. Don't think so. I don't know. I mean, we didn't have a great many very young children, only about 3 or 4. And because mostly Japan wasn't considered a suitable place, they were at school in England. So I don't really remember many children.
You were telling me earlier about how you went out ostensibly to the dentist, but managed to buy some books. Did you also have books inside the compound that you could use?
Oh, yes, because there was an embassy library anyway. And people had enormous amounts of books in their own houses.
So you didn't really go short of
reading
matter?
Oh, no, not at all. Not at all. No.
How about other materials, if you wanted to sew or paint, do this sort of thing?
I've no idea. I honestly can't tell you. I presume people who did paint had their paints and had their canvases and the embroiderers had their embroidery already there.
Were classes organised?
Yes,
inside?
As I remember, there were classes. I mean, a Mr. Ballantyne spoke Spanish, so he had a Spanish class. And there were various sort of... Well, I think the English do this. They're great self-improvers. So everybody instantly had a sort of... Well, there was a chess class and, the Spanish class and the German class run by Miss Minns. And... I can't remember exact details, but I know there were classes, bridge classes. My mother gave bridge classes because she was an international player. And so she taught bridge.
How did your mother stand up to this? Did you notice any difference, you know, in her
behaviour? No, she was never a frightfully strong person, but she stood up to it all right. I mean, she was in her element. She could organise people. She was a great organiser of people, and... I mean, she didn't organise people unless she was asked to do so, but she got asked to do so, and she used to sort of visit the houses if there was a crisis in a house and sort of behave more or less like a vicar's wife.
How did these sanitary arrangements stand up? You know, you were saying how extra people came into the houses. Did this cause inconvenience?
The plumbing seemed to survive. We had English plumbing, the Great Niagara were the loos. They were actually called the Great Niagara, and they were all English baths and English lavatory basins and everything. They seemed to survive it perfectly well.
And you managed to keep up the
supply? I think we had sort of bath nights. I don't think we could have a bath every night. I think we had our allotted bath nights. I just have a vague recollection of that.
But did you continue to get toothpaste and soap and all the toiletries you required?
Well, again, you see, we had them. They were, again, in these sort of various supplies in the houses, and the soap. Houses had their own supplies of soap because, after all, one was a very long way in Japan, away from civilization, and Japan wasn't all that civilized in those days, so any Western luxuries had to be brought in with you. So when people went on holiday, or on leave, rather, they used to bring back vast quantities of soap or vast quantities of writing paper, tin food, whatever it was.
Were there any animals inside the compound?
Yes, there were. People, practically, I suppose every other house had a dog. We didn't. My father didn't have a dog, but people did have dogs. And it was decided that the only thing to do was to kill the dogs. So this created frightful ill feeling. The Japanese said, I think, that we had to kill them. In fact, I don't think it was our idea. Oh, yes, no, that's right. It was our idea to kill them, because otherwise what were they going to eat? And all the people who'd come inside from outside had brought in their pets. And I remember that all the pets were put into a horse box and the exhaust of a car was put in, and they were taken away. I don't remember the details of where they were taken away to, because I was sort of shielded from that, as it was thought to be nasty for me. But Lady Craigie was allowed to keep her peak, which created frightful little feeling. And it was the most awful thing, because when we were repatriated and we were in Lorenzo Marks, the peak went and hanged itself on the lead on the end of the bed by mistake, so she didn't get away with her peak at the end of it all anyway. But the peak was a sort of symbol of hatred of Lady Craigie, and people were furious who had had to have beautiful Alsatians put down and Doberman Pinschers and sort of really beautiful dogs. There was a lot of severe ill feeling over that.
Lady Craigie doesn't sound a very popular lady.
She wasn't. She was very American. And she was very much a cosseted wife. She had one of the finest and largest private collections of black and white jade. And the whole of Number One House was covered in this jade collection, all of which came out with her. Oh, yes, I mean, the packers came in and packed it, and it was all... Because when we were repatriated, we had professional packers. We got all our furniture back and everything. Well, we didn't have... I don't think the houses... Actually, all the houses were furnished with Ministry of Works stuff, but it was all brought back, I think. I can't be sure about that.
What was Lady Craigie's role... during this period of internment, did she take an interest in the other internees?
Not much, no.
Did she appear on any occasions?
Only very grand. I mean, if the Craigies were asked, I mean, she was almost a royal figure. She was, I think, a pain in the neck to my mother. My mother had to deal with her mostly, who got on with her, but no, Lady Craigie was considered to be a considerable problem, I remember.
You were saying about your ping-pong, and you played badminton, I think, or was it squash as well?
Both.
Yes. Did you have any drama? Did you put on sort of concerts or plays?
Yes, we had gramophone concerts. We didn't put on plays, but we had gramophone concerts. Because I see from this that I'd been over to various houses and had performance of Elijah by Handel or something... Because people like, for instance, the Gore Booths were incredibly musical, and he had vast quantities of gramophone records. And I think people had more gramophone records those days than now, probably, because nowadays there are concerts in most places, but in Japan there were practically no concerts. So people had to make their own entertainment. So people consequently had more gramophone records.
Did you find people were quite generous, you know, with their resources?
Oh, Lord, yes, very.
There was an amount of sharing.
Oh, tremendous amount of sharing. I mean, people, looking back, people were absolutely incredible because, there were no sort of major rows. I suppose at worst, perhaps, somebody like Mrs. Cowley had to be moved from one house to another because she was quite intolerable. And poor Mr. Cowley was nearly in tears with Marika. He was a poor little wet, feeble man. He was completely ruled by the dreaded Mrs. Cowley. And if you had an absolute sort of pain in the neck like Mrs. Cowley, well, then obviously people would try to move her. But we put up with Mrs. Cowley, as I remember. But there were sort of small dramas in houses, but nothing major, and people got on quite incredibly well with hindsight.
What was the organisation like? Were you conscious that you were being sort of controlled and organised at all by the Japanese? Did they interfere?
The Japanese didn't control and organise us at all.
So what would the organisation have been like within the English people themselves? You know, were sort of rules and regulations brought into being?
Well, we had rules about what time you went to see Mrs. Mason for food, for instance. And, I mean, we went on having lunch at 1 o'clock in the ordinary way. And if you were having a party, you went and told your servants, and your servants, you were told that you could probably get some food from Mr. Gore Booth's house, for instance. You might have got some food from there, or he'd offer to lend something, his wife would offer to lend something that she might have, for instance, had a tin of peaches from Mrs. Mason and then decided the tin of peaches could be pudding at her party or at somebody else. She would offer to lend a tin of peaches in exchange, sort of barter system, as I remember, but I don't remember any great details. The only thing I do remember is we had an Indian language officer called Himat Singhji, who was the nephew of the great cricketer Duleep Singhji. And he used to give tremendous curry parties, and he had his own Indian servant who stayed the whole time and cooked these enormous curries, because he was nearly considered almost royal. And he gave me a string of pearls for my birthday.
You had a birthday inside, did you?
I had my 17th birthday inside, yes.
Did you have a celebration, a party for that?
Yes, I think I did. I got given a lovely string of Mikimoto pearls by my parents and a pearl clip by Lady Craigie. It was in the form of a bunch of grapes with white pearls and black pearls. It was very smart. And Himat Singhji gave me a string of pearls. So I was well away with pearls. All the Mikimoto, you know, cultured pearls, which in those days were sort of more or less unheard of in the Western world. And I think we had a party for my birthday. And I remember extracting a promise from my father that when we got out, I need never go back to school.
The biggest birthday present ever.
That's right. It was indeed.
You must have had a Christmas inside as well, is that right?
Yes, we did.